Into the Weird, Episode 6, Satanic Cheesecake.
Into the Weird, the podcast where we explore the madness of the mighty Marvel Bronze Age. I'm a reasonable facsimile of Grant Richter, and with me, as always, is the brains of the show, the master of darkness himself, host of the Long Box of Darkness podcast, Mr. Herman Lowe.
Wow, nice to be back, Grant. Thanks for that undeserved introduction. I mean, you really blew my horn there. At least you didn't blow something
else. Well,
you
bought me a few drinks. What are you going to do?
Hey, that's how we roll, man. Possibly because of the time we record.
Yeah, could be. I got the house to myself. You're up late. What are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, make sure we'll be undisturbed. For as long as we can. We'll see how we go. But how have you been, buddy? It's been, 3 months since the last time we got together?
I have no idea. I'm okay. I barely know what I'm doing from day to day. I'm happy if I remember to put on pants before I head out the door. Things are okay.
Moment to moment.
Yeah. I'm living my true self.
Carpe diem. Yeah. No, that's the way we should do it. I'm a little bit, when I look at the next day, I get depressed. So I'm probably going to follow in your footsteps. I'm going to take your advice. And, I don't want to look too far ahead. But we've got comics. That's the balm to our existential wounds.
Yes.
Definitely. And today we're going to be talking about yet another weird tale from Marvel. Grant, not Doctor Strange this time around.
We
focus on Doctor Strange a lot. We're going to talk about him later in the show, at least in part from one of my segments. But today we're focusing on Morbius again, my favorite Marvel character. And I'm thinking one of your favorite supernatural characters in Marvel as well, if I'm not mistaken.
One of my favorite supernatural characters and probably my second favorite run of that character in Vampire Tales.
That's right. Vampire Tales number one.
For those of you who don't know, is a super cool black and white mag that Marvel put out back in the early 70s. It did not adhere to the Comics Code Authority, which meant it was a little more gritty than your everyday stuff. And I really, really like this book.
Same here. Yeah, I mean, they released it on Marvel Unlimited about 2 years ago, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. But a couple of years before that, because, when I was a kid, Grant, I don't know about you, I never read Vampire Tales. It was one of the magazines that I really couldn't get my hands on. But
yeah, it was before my time.
Yeah, I think in 2006 or 2007, they released these small digest-sized Marvel trades, which is smaller than your normal trade paperback. And there was three of them, Vampire Tales 1 to 3, and they contain the entire run. Mm-hmm. And I picked those up. Now they're out of stock on Amazon, at least. I guess you can find some on eBay, but it reprints all the Vampire Tales stories. That's where I first read Vampire Tales, about 10 or so years ago. So I'm actually, as a horror fan, I'm coming in late to this series. I used to read a lot of Morbius, from his Adventures into Fear run in the 70s and his appearances in Amazing Spider-Man and, his own series later on, which we discussed on previous episodes. But Vampire Tales is kind of a new horror mag to me. And I'm so glad they did reprint those. And now that's on Marvel Unlimited, we can read them at our leisure. So what did you think when you first encountered Vampire Tales?
I want to save that. I'm going to put a pin in that until we get to the madness and the brilliance. So,
well, I mean,
missteps and brilliance. Yeah.
To just tell the listeners, we're going to be talking about the first issue of Vampire Tales, but we're not going to be discussing all the stories in it because some parts are prose and some are a few short horror tales, not related to the Morbius story at all. So we're going to be looking at the Morbius story written by Steve Gerber, with art by Pablo Marcos, because after all, Morbius is one of the weird characters we've discussed before and whom we've decided to focus on.
And this book really came out right at the height of the kind of Dracula craze of the early 70s, which I'm a big fan of. I love like 70s and Hammer films, Dracula movies.
Oh, same here, man. I think that's where we're on the same page. We love Hammer. And of course, lots of people do, but I loved it from the get-go, from the first time I saw a Hammer film. I think my first Hammer film was The Satanic Rites of Dracula, which is kind of a big deal for, anyone growing up in a religious-orientated society like South Africa was in the 70s, So it's amazing that movie could make it past the censors just on the title alone.
I don't remember what movie it was for me, but I know that from the time I was 4, my mom used to let me stay up till like way too late in the night on a Friday evening to watch what was called Double Chiller Theater in the town where I grew up in. And it would start at like 11:30 at night, and then they'd play one kind of sci-fi horror movie and then another one. And I remember, I know it was a Christopher Lee Dracula movie. That's all I know. And I was like terrified and hooked all at the same time.
Wow.
Don't let your kids stay up till like 1 in the morning to watch Dracula movies. That's all I can say.
That's great.
You end up like us.
No, that's right. We're definitely ruined, but in a good way. At least it's an enjoyable way for us. These things that we like. But Christopher Lee's my Dracula. I'm sure he's your Dracula too. That's the guy who introduced me. And he's so different from the Marvel Dracula, which we'll probably talk about on another podcast in the near future. But I do like him. And I think because of, like you mentioned, the popularity of the time, vampires were in. And we're not talking 1990s Anne Rice vampires or early 2000s, with the Twilight stuff here. We're talking real horror, gross kind of half zombie-like vampires that Marvel was known for. And the other magazines like Creepy and Eerie too.
I think the interesting thing about the Marvel Dracula is I want to say his creation was kind of inspired by the Christopher Lee performance. But then I think the kind of sexy Dracula that the Marvel Dracula was, in a way, especially when Claremont would get a hold of him, would inspire the like later 70s kind of Frank Langella sexy Dracula portrayals.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, it's been...
Which is an awful, awful fucking movie.
Yeah, true. I'm not a fan, but there was a made-for-TV movie in the late 70s starring Jack Palance as Dracula. And I think Marv Wolfman... Or not Marv Wolfman, I think it was Jerry Conway who said that he, suggested to the artists, which wasn't in Gene Colan from the very get-go onwards, he suggested that they should, base the look of Dracula on Jack Palance. And you can see a little bit of Palance's Dracula in there, but of course, I wouldn't think Jack Palance and Dracula in the same sentence even. I wouldn't even use those two names together, but he did it. Yeah. That's where the look for the Marvel one came from. But they, of course, tweaked it over the years.
Oh, yeah.
It changed. Right. It became its own thing. Much more legendary than that film, I'm sure.
Yeah, but, Sexy Beard Dracula.
Exactly. But this issue here, Grant, that was, like you say, in the height of the vampire popularity. 1973 was when this, issue was released. And then, it was, of course, edited by Roy Thomas. And the writing staff was Marv Wolfman, Jerry Conway, Don McGregor, Tony Isabella, Murray Friedman. So that they're, big writers at the time on this thing. And there's also in this particular issue, they had young and up and coming guys like Chris Claremont and Mark Evanier also doing some stories. And then, of course, you have the very the legends, Gardner Fox. He's also here, which is a surprise to me. But he's apparently a big horror fan. Gardner Fox, you normally credit him with the Silver Age of DC Comics, Green Lantern and so forth. But no, he Hawkman and those kind of things. But he knew what he was doing with horror. And then, of course, Steve Gerber is in this issue as well.
So, I
want to ask you.
Amazing art by Pablo Marcos, too.
Oh, yeah. That's probably going to be both of our, you know, for both of us, the highlights of this issue, the art. I love it. It's amazing. But what do you, first, speaking about the art, Grant, what do you think about the cover? I mean, it's done by Esteban Morato, who is one of the Filipino guys that they got over.
Not a fan.
Yeah, the cover's a little bit
It's too generic.
Yeah.
It's just kind of a generic vampire, you know, Bela Lugosi inspired kind of guy.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's fine.
I think the guy that he intended to portray on the cover is supposed to be one of the characters in this first issue, Lord Ruthven, you know, the sort of blonde-haired vampire. I love Esteban Morato, but I have to agree with you. This is not one of his best images. And also the color kind of muddies it a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know who did the colors, but I'm assuming it's him because they credit him in the issue cover by Esteban Morato. So, yeah. But we're not going to get into too much of Morbius's history in this episode, Grant, because we discussed that during our fourth episode, when we talked about Morbius and his first appearance of Spider-Man. But suffice to say that the reason why they picked Morbius for this issue, though, is because he was very popular. He made a big splash when he appeared in Spider-Man and then in the X-Men as well. And, of course, they decided, hey, he's more of a horror-oriented character. Let's put him in Vampire Tales, but let's keep him in the superhero universe, too, because he's doing so well there, at, you know, on two fronts.
Yeah, I'm especially looking forward to when we get to his appearance in Marvel 2-in-1.
Oh, yes, yes. And we should mention to the listeners that we might include Marvel 2-in-1 in our weird mixed bag of comics that we might discuss in the future.
Oh, it's for sure by now. Yeah, definitely. The ones with the Man Thing and Morbius and Deathlok and
We have to include those. Yeah, we didn't mention
Crown.
In the past. Yeah, but now that I think about it, those issues were strange. Some of those were just batshit crazy, but I love them. So we're going to do them eventually. But Brent, I'm quickly going to give a synopsis of the Morbius story in this one, and then we can start talking about the storyline itself and the art as we progress through the comic book. So here, dear listeners, follows a brief synopsis. Okay. Morbius finds himself in Los Angeles, searching for his lost lover, Martine, hoping that she could help him effect a cure for his hated condition. Preying on the helpless human populace, he soon meets the beautiful Carolyn, or Carrie, as she prefers to be called, who turns out to be a member of the Cult of Satan. She tells him that she can help him find the one he loves, and takes him to Madame Lyra, a medium and fortune teller. Madame Lyra's locator spell goes awry when Morbius sees the death of Martine in her crystal bowl, and in a fit of rage, he smashes it, releasing a demon called Nilrak. After an epic battle with said demon, Morbius snacks on Madame Lyra, leaving a weeping Carolyn to clean up the bloody mess. And that's a brief synopsis of the Morbius tale. So, Grant, what did you think about the story as a whole? Let's not think about the art yet, but the story.
The story is okay. And I'll get into this more when we get into missteps and brilliance. Mm. It's not as good as the rest of the series, but it's a good introduction to Morbius for a reader that's not familiar with him. It's got a really brief summary of his origin, a page and a half summary. It establishes him as a true anti-hero, you know, not just what we think of as anti-hero now is like, you know, Wolverine, the guy who goes a little too far to do good deeds. It's a good person who literally does bad things.
Exactly. He's one of the few characters, at least in a Marvel superhero universe, who's at the mercy of his impulses. You know, one of the few anti-heroes, like you called him, who's got that problem. I mean, you've got the Hulk Bruce Banner who loses control, but it's not the same thing. You know, here he is already Morbius, and then, you know, he cannot control his thirst. So he murders innocent victims at random, seemingly.
And that was something I was going to ask you about, because you know more about Morbius than I do. Does Morbius have to drink blood, or is he just addicted to drinking blood?
No, he has to. In these early issues, he hasn't mastered... later on, he'll create a serum, you know, to master the thirst, or to control the thirst at least. But in these early appearances, he can't control it at all. Okay. So he's just going...
Well, I mean, is it like he has to drink blood to live, or is it like... Yes. A drug addict jonesing for heroin.
Well, it later on becomes the drug addict, the addiction. But right now, it's literally a matter of life and death. In the Adventures into Fear issues, you'll see them talk about that quite a lot. If he goes too long, kind of like Namor being out of water, the Submariner, you know, without water, eventually he'll die. Morbius is the same. If he starves himself, or, you know, they've never actually... discussed that in length, but I mean, they mentioned it a couple of times. If he subsists on animal blood, it won't sustain him either. So it needs to be human plasma, as he sometimes puts it, human plasma. That's what he needs. So he's definitely going to die if he doesn't give in to his needs or his thirst.
Now, Steve Gerber didn't assign a title to the story. He just called it Morbius, but I have come up with a title of my own. I call it Morbius versus the Girls of the Legion of Superheroes. If you go through the art, and readers, if you have, well, we'll probably put some pictures up on our blog, but if you have Marvel Unlimited, I look at it. He, at the very beginning, he attacks a random girl who looks a lot like Saturn Girl.
I agree.
or 70s Saturn Girl.
Yeah.
And then when he meets the first Satanist girl, she looks like blonde Shadow Lass. And then Madame Lyra looks like gender swap Timberwolf. So,
good one.
Yeah, but I'm going to talk about these young ladies more when we get to our side segments.
That was a great.
I really
comparison.
Like this. This is a lot of fun issue. It's not my. It's my least favorite issue of the series.
Yes.
But it's still a really fun issue. Like, so the bar is really high. My least favorite issue is still really good.
That's good to hear. Yeah. Yeah. This is definitely my least favorite issues too. Great issue too. Great introduction, like you mentioned. But it's got this weird, but very basic story. Where it's just about Morbius, who meets this totally random girl who immediately takes a shine to Morbius, even though he's got this horrible pug nose. He's not at all physically attractive, but she immediately, you know, falls for him, I think, you know, and then she takes him to this fortune teller who's a part of her satanic cult to help him to find Martine, who he's looking for, his ex-girlfriend. So, you know, yeah, the story doesn't make any sense. But, you know, it's great because it showcases three aspects of Morbius. First being his thirst, which is completely, you know, just out of his control. And then the second being hot chicks, hot women.
Right.
They always show up in Morbius stories. Always.
It's amazing. But again, I'm going to talk about that more in a little bit.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the prerequisites for these adult-oriented Marvel mags in the 70s. But still, even in the Adventures into Fear run, you know, if you've got Morbius and hot chicks. And then the third staple being random supernatural events that just seems to happen, that just seems to follow Morbius around for no... I mean, in this issue, he literally breaks a crystal ball. And then suddenly a demon pops out and starts wrestling him. I mean, that's really as weird as you get.
So, yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, very good stuff. But I agree with you that the girls all look like Mike Grell, 70s, you know, Legion characters. Mm-hmm. The first girl, definitely, I would say Satin Girl. Her name's Barbara.
The disc belt.
Yeah.
And you know, that even though it's in black and white, I see that mini dress that she's wearing is pink.
Oh, yeah.
So it just reminds me of Saturn Girl's like battle bikini from the 70s Legion.
Yeah, I don't know if you agree, but Pablo Marcus's art does look a lot like Mike Grell's for me. At least in the 70s, it did look like that.
Yeah, especially Grell's Warlord stuff.
Mm, yeah, I agree. And also his Legion stuff. I mean, he was doing... Legion, I think, at the time, or just after this, a few years after this, he was doing Legion. But, you know, I like the way he draws Morbius. there's a particular scene where Morbius is going through a flashback, you know?
Yeah, I'm looking at that right now.
Oh, yeah, me too. Wow, that is an amazing bit of art there.
Because was it Gil Kane that did the art in the Spider-Man ones that we...
Yes.
Yeah, because Morbius looks, you know, cartoonish in that one and kind of silly, but damn, the amount of detail that Marcos puts in this is great. Just the wrinkles in his face, and it's, you know, you can tell he doesn't just have a goofy bat nose. You can actually see where his face has kind of been scrunched up to fit the contours of his deformations.
Exactly. And I love the way Marcos draws his brows. You know, you've got these thick, you know, lined brows with a shadow, you know, in the middle, making him, you know, look like one of those characters who are always angst ridden, or, you know, they've got the weight of the world on their shoulders and on their foreheads.
And that little kind of soul patch thing that he has, his little mini beard at the bottom, it really frames his face just right. It's silly because, you know, it's supposed to, you know, make a like stereotypical Judeo-Christian devil look about it, but just the way he does his hair, and then the way that the eyebrows and the little beard thing draw your eyes together, it's really good. It's just good, not just stylistic art, but good structured art too.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, and the way, you know, that Gerber wrote it as well, you know, the way that he frames the story in the beginning with Los Angeles, and then you quickly go from character to character. You jump from this Barbara Clark who's walking along, and then she goes into an alley, and Morbius murders her effectively, and then immediately introduces the flashback sequence, which is great. And then after the flashback, which would catch up, you know, in two pages, he would catch up any reader who didn't even know who Morbius was from, you know, the Spider-Man issue. You would immediately know everything that you need to know.
Right.
He quickly moves to the next batch of characters, which includes this girl who meets Morbius on the street. And, you know, she is very distinctive looking with the sort of crucifix or cross tattooed on her, on both of her cheeks, actually.
And yep, they look more like Red Cross logos.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking this is the last thing I would think about.
She's like a hippie Satanist. Yeah, the way they do it reminds me of like the Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, the way Goldie Hawn was always portrayed, having like the weird little things painted on her face and on her tummy and stuff. It reminds me of that.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, that's a good image to invoke if you think about this girl. But, you know, at the time, at least, you know, the concept of Satanism or the view of Satanism, the perspective people had about it at the time was malevolent. And here she's sort of disproving that notion. Gerber treats her and her cult sympathetically. They're helpful. She's trying to help him. But she might only be trying to help him because he looks like a devil. But
right.
I mean, of course, these days we know that Satanism isn't actually, you know, well, the modern Satanists try to say that it's not a malevolent.
It's metaphorical for free thought. Yeah, she's more like the Satanist that sued Netflix over Sabrina the Teenage, over the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know,
is a really good show, by the way, if you haven't watched it.
Oh, yeah. I've watched a few episodes of the first season, but that's one of those episodes that's tied to my wife's viewing schedule. You know, I've got a lot of time to watch it, but she doesn't. So I have to kind of wait on her to get to it. I don't know if you have the same situation.
Pretty much. Well, it's the opposite. Is I don't have the attention span to sit down and watch TV by myself. So I don't watch TV unless my wife's in the room with me.
But, you know, I kind of love Sabrina's, you know, portrayal of Satanism more than, you know, most modern interpretations. And, you know, like you say, it likens back to this one. You know, it's very similar to this cult. And it seems that this cult includes this vast network of super attractive women who have a variety of skills. I mean, she takes him to see this Madame Lyra. This girl, Carolyn, I don't know if I mentioned her name before. I think I mentioned her name in the synopsis. But she immediately tells Morbius to call her Carrie. And then, you know, Morbius mentions the fact that he's looking for Martine. So she takes him over to see this Madame Lyra. And Grant, at this point in time, I was thinking, oh, it's going to be a crone. It's going to be a hag. It's going to be this typical witch-like woman. No, Madame Lyra is even sexier than the other girls we saw introduced. So, again, that's something we're going to mention later, probably in the Mighty Marvel misstep segment.
What I think is great, though, even though, you know, these girls are ridiculously dressed, they're, you know, obviously very provocatively dressed, and they're, you know, very curvy in a good way, they're not, it's not like over the top proportions either. They don't have Barbie doll waists and you know, like Jessica, they're not Jessica Rabbit proportions. They're what a well-endowed and attractive woman would probably really, you know, would really look like in, you know, a ridiculous connotation, but it's still really good anatomy. It's not, you know, one of, you know, I'm not a big fan of Mike Deodato, even though he's very popular, especially his stuff in the early 2000s, because, you know, he does the kind of Jim Lee thing where like every woman's spine has to be like a slightly broken and deformed to be able to do some of the poses that they do. He's gotten a lot better, but that's kind of my example for, you know, bad, somewhat realistic anatomy. This is really realistic anatomy. It's improbable, but it's realistic.
I agree with you. No, he's got a very he draws the female form very well. I'm talking about Pablo Marcos here. The only small criticism I would actually give is that the feet of the characters are incredibly small.
That's true.
But you know, the rest is perfect. So, you know, there's no out of proportion bits. And you know, he draws great action panels too, right, Grant? When eventually Morbius sees this image of Martine with a dagger right below her, you know, right breast, and in this crystal ball that Madame Lyra's using, he smashes it, and then this demon Nilrak comes out, and this is a great series of panels where he fights this demon. Of course, this makes absolutely no sense. Like, why would a demon just jump out of the crystal ball?
Jump out of the crystal ball? Like, I don't know.
But
I couldn't tell if it was supposed to be coming out of the crystal ball, or like Madame Lyra has like this demon statue in her apartment, and I didn't know if maybe he threw the crystal ball at the statue and it brought the statue to life. I don't know.
Yeah, it's
but
weird.
Like you said, it doesn't make any sense, but it's still fun.
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, it's just an excuse to get some, you know, Morbius to fight some mean antagonist.
It's very Conan-esque.
Yeah, I mean, Conan always walks into a shrine or in a, you know, a ruined temple, and then disturbs something.
Yeah.
Becomes a demon.
And a fight happens because of a fight.
Yeah.
My only criticism of Marcos's artwork is he does the thing that I can't stand, which is a sexy dead lady.
I know the
lady he attacks at the beginning. She's laying there sexy dead, and then in the crystal ball you see Martine sexy with a dagger in her chest, and then Madame Lyra sexy dead at the end. I'm like, I don't like that.
Yeah,
but
no, I agree.
You know, it looks really good, but it's, you know, that's not great.
Yeah, well, it was recently done again in, you know, DC when they showed
Heroes in Crisis.
Yeah, Heroes in Crisis, Death of Poison Ivy. That was really disturbing, and of course, I hoped we had moved past that. You see that a lot in the black and white magazines of the 60s and 70s, mostly not the Marvel magazines though, but you know, the Warren magazines, and you know, that's something that always put me off. If she's sleeping in a sexy pose, I can handle that, you know. They right. often show characters like that because that's very alluring, but yeah, once she's dead and they show her lying like that, no, it's just it changes the whole dynamic. And you know, then, I don't know about you, Grant, something weird happens. I don't think I've seen this before, although I think it happens once in Adventures into Fear, in that Morbius run. Morbius actually kills this demon by drinking his demonic blood. But he has no blood. Well, what happens is Morbius bites him in the neck. And then, you know, the demon just dissolves into fiery, like a bonfire right there on the carpet. But that was a little bit weird to me, the fact that Morbius is not adverse to snacking on basically anything.
Oh, yeah, you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah. And then immediately, since he wasn't satisfied, he jumps on Madame Lyra. And he just kills her right then and there. And he calls the blood the nectar, which freaked me out a bit. You know, he says, like, this is the truth, Lyra, the hunger, the pain, the nectar.
Yeah, that was a little Anne Ricey.
Yeah, that was a bit too much. The description there disturbing. But still, Gerber, you know, a master of pacing, even at this very early stage of his writing career. And then, you know, you've got Carolyn, luckily, escaping because Morbius lets her go. Presumably, but you know, then there's again one of these poses on the final page, right, Grant, where Carolyn's lying on the sofa They've just, you know, had a bit of a rest, and she's looking very sexy. But, you know, I don't mind it there because, you know, she's talking.
Not sexy unconscious is not as bad as sexy dead.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So you've got that. But, you know, all in all, a great issue. But you've got this final three panels where Morbius bids her farewell forever. And then she cries. So that alone is also a little bit illogical for me, because how could she have fallen in love with Morbius in the span of, what, 2 hours?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's weird. Or maybe she's just, you know, so into Morbius' story of his lost love, Martine. I don't know.
I don't know. Like, like I said, this is my least favorite part, partly for that reason, partly for reasons I'll get into in a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that basically concludes the first story, you know, the only one we're going to be concerning ourselves with. But just to give the listeners a bit of a, you know, more comprehensive view of the comic, Grant, I'm just quickly going to read the introduction to the rest of the stories of the table of contents, just so that they know what they would get, you know, if they read the whole comic book. The second story is called Blood is Thicker. And then it's basically just the editorial. It's not really a story. It's, you know, the mission statement of Vampire Tales as a magazine. And then you've got the first real proper story after the Morbius tale, To Kill a Werewolf. And they say here in the description, a most laudable ambition, perhaps, presumably referring to the title To Kill a Werewolf, unless the lycanthropic throwback in question happens to be yourself. So it's a tale where a person becomes a werewolf. And Grant, I don't know, did you read this story?
I probably skimmed through it when I first read this several months ago, but it didn't really stick in my brain.
Okay, I would suggest that readers do read it, because it contains this very famous little panel, which you can find all over the internet or all over Pinterest if you type in weird pages or weird panels or horror panels of comics. And it's the scene of this werewolf. It's one of my favorite images. This werewolf with this only three legs. He's a three-legged werewolf, but he's in the form of a wolf. But he still retains his ability to speak, and he's lamenting his fate that he's transformed into a werewolf. So he screams, "Oh, what'll I do? What'll I do?" And he goes into this werewolf howl. It's just great. I'm going to post that image on the blog as well after we conclude the episode, because it's so cool the way it's drawn and the way the howl become, you know, the words flow into this howl.
Gotcha.
Sad. And then there's a tale called a bit of a prose piece called The Vampire, His Kith and Kin, which is kind of interesting because it discusses the entire history of vampires and literature, really, up until this point, you know, when this magazine was published. And then you've got a tale called The Vampire, which is basically a direct adaptation of the story written by Polidori, you know, the Dr. John Polidori, the friend of Lord Byron and Mary Shelley, who, you know, in that famous night, all four of them were tasked with coming up with a tale and, you know, to tell each other. And Mary Shelley came up with Frankenstein, and John Polidori came up with this tale, The Vampire, and so forth. So, you know, very interesting. But, you know, not really very special. You can just as well read the original. And then the last one, Satan Can Wait. And then there's the worst vampire films ever made. Bit of an editorial piece there. And the last one, Revenge of the Unliving, which features a movie. You know, the movie The Omen, that scene where the weather vane impales the priest. That is actually in this story. I mean, this is way before The Omen was made. I don't know if the filmmakers got it from that. But, you know, fun little stories. But the main story of Morbius is really the reason why anybody should pick up this issue.
Yeah.
So, Grant, I think we can get into our next segment, which is our Bronze Age Brilliance and Mighty Marvel Missteps.
Back.
Yep. So, Grant, what was your Bronze Age Brilliance in this issue?
Well, I've talked about it enough. It should be pretty obvious by now. And as much as I dislike cheesecake in comics, I thought the pretty girls were really fun in this, because it's just so silly that, apparently in early 1970s, hot satanic girls were everywhere, and I just missed out. Because again, I have a type.
Oh, yeah.
But it's just. It really is the highlight, because there's not a whole lot that's really special about this story. I mean, it takes place in New York, like most Marvel things do. The monster is kind of generic. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. But I mean, the two satanic girls are really what kind of captures your attention, and it's dumb, and it's probably a little misogynistic for them to put it in the story in the first place. But it is a silly kind of fun.
Yeah, I agree. It's very, very silly, but it needs to be in this story, and something I've come to associate with Morbius, and it enhances the tale for me. Not because I'm just lusting after these girls, but because, if you're a Satanist trying to lure someone into a cult, if and you're a girl, it's going to be that much easier if you're attractive.
Right.
So, and vampires always seem to go after hot girls.
Well,
That's
yeah.
just the thing that they have. So, this makes sense, but it's true now what that you mention it, talking about your type, right, Grant? I just to give you an example, you remember in the 80s when the X-Men had that whole Inferno storyline in the late 80s,
The Goblin Queen.
the Goblin Queen, Mark Silvestri era. Madeline Pryor never really did it for me until she went full on Demon Queen, persona. Then she really started to become a character that I paid attention to, not just because she was sexy, but because she suddenly gained this whole new,
Darkness.
darkness to her and this whole, new level of interest for me. So yeah, there's something about these girls, and they stem out of the 70s, I think. The Marvel era, probably in DC too. There were a couple of, DC horror titles that also focused on them a little bit, but mostly Marvel. And then Marvel in turn got it from Vampirella. From the Warren magazines in the late 60s.
And that's actually what Madame Lyra reminds me of, is the character. I think it's Panther or something like that.
Panther.
I'm not real big on those books, but I'm not super familiar with them. But that's kind of what it reminds me of.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely have, like, my second ever TV crush was from Morticia Adams from reruns of The Addams Family. So yeah.
Cara mia. Yeah, but I agree with you. These dark, mysterious ladies, they definitely have some kind of hold over us, and we can't control it. But so that's your Bronze Age brilliance, right? Okay, mine is going to be more generalized. I'm going to say the art as a whole, because Pablo Marcos in black and white, man, that really comes through strongly. I've seen a lot of his stuff in color, but I've also seen a lot of his things in black and white. But I've forgotten how much I love this guy, how much I love his art, and especially when he's doing one of my favorite characters like Morbius. I just couldn't find a panel where Morbius looks, bad.
Doesn't look good,
Yeah, he looks good in every single panel Marcos draws. Of course, like I mentioned, Marcos has got the thing with the feet, but it's not in every panel. He draws, feet fine. It's just in a couple of panels where it seems that, especially with the ladies. Where,
It all seems like the angle of the foot is just weird. Like the where you first see Madame Lyra, her left foot is kind of canted away from the camera, and it makes her foot look tiny. But I think it's just a perspective issue.
maybe he just had a thing for geisha type girls with these
Maybe,
little broken ankles, and this was pre-hentai, so but still,
Pre
no, I'm kidding.
Rob Liefeld.
Yeah, everything pre Liefeld is good. Oh, no, I shouldn't say that. This is a bad thing to say.
No.
Look, I dig Rob. I'm not gonna go into his stuff. I don't like his art, but he generated some. I mean, Cable, Deadpool, some of,
Oh
well,
yeah.
Cable's your one of your favorite characters.
His concept basics are good, and then what other people do with them is considerably better. And I don't give Rob any credit for being a good dude anymore, because I learned some stuff about him that I'm not fond of, but I'm not going to get into it here.
Yeah, well, I should be careful what I say about artists, because I should frame my comments to be more, I don't know. I should take everything into account, because remember 2 episodes ago I really, gave Gil Kane a hard time. Do you remember? And we got some quite a bit of, comments Flack. About that. Yeah, Flack. I mean, Gil Kane is a legend. It's true. His art just doesn't do it for me. It's like, you know, I'm slaughtering a sacred cow here, but I just want to tell it like it is. I do appreciate what he's done for the industry, though. I mean, he co-created Morbius, you know, so that alone, you know, makes him...
I'm okay with his art in general. I just didn't like the way he drew Morbius. He made him too cartoony, and it made him a little too, I don't know, like his face was a little too weirdly geometric or something. I don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, this goes back quite a ways, Grant. We also didn't like the way he drew Warlock.
Oh, that's true.
But, you know, be that as it may, the guy is an industry legend. I appreciate him.
I respect him.
Yeah, just like Liefeld to an extent. He's a legend in terms of the era that he sort of ushered in. Along with the other folks who started Image and, you know, who was at Marvel at the time just before Image started. I mean, those guys are legends, but for different reasons than, you know, others might consider them to be legends. I don't particularly enjoy their art. I love them because of the intellectual properties they, you know, created and, you know, set loose in the industry. I like that. Right.
Yeah, and very rarely will you guys hear us say someone is a bad artist. We may say we don't like that person's art or that person's art may not be for us, but unless we're talking about John Mallon, we're never going to say someone's a bad artist.
Ah, great. Good one, man.
I said it. Yep.
Yeah, you had to. Well, I'm glad you said it. I'm glad you said it. One of us had to. No, I agree with you, Grant. But I'm just going to go with the easy answer and say Pablo Marcus's art. And of course, Gerber did a good job, but this is kind of one of those stories I think he phoned it in, sort of, a little bit. Mm-hmm. And even then, it's still good. Or it was a rush job. He might have gotten the job at the last, you know, moment.
Yeah, it's definitely not your stereotypical Gerber story.
Yeah, there's no deep political satire or magical realism. I mean, the closest you'd get is probably Madame Lyra.
Right, It's not taking the piss out of both sides of politics.
No.
Most, but this was, this probably about 4 or 5 years before he'd get into the Defenders, I think. Yeah, so,
I think this was just literally a work-for-hire kind of thing where, you know, he just had to come up with a story. And he did it. Yeah. You know, and he did it well. Yeah. Okay,
so... These are his baby steps.
That's right. And I'm so glad he was there at the time, thank goodness.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if not for Gerber, I probably wouldn't have enjoyed half of the 70s as much as I eventually did. But later on, of course, I know he's not, you know, you like him, Grant, but he's not one of your favorite writers of all time. Not. Yeah.
Yeah, I can take him in small doses, but his particular sense of humor doesn't do it for me. Yeah. But, you know, I respect his work.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's just each to his own. You know, for me, I mean, he's probably one of my top three best comic book writers of all time. I really love the guy. But, you know, from another person's perspective, not just yours, but many, many, many people that I've spoken to in the past, you know, I can see their points, and I can appreciate what, you know, how they feel when they get tired of Gerber's stuff. But, I just can't. I just love the guy so much. But, you know, like I said, not one of his best tales. So I'm going to go with the art on this one. But, Grant, what about the Mighty Marvel missteps? Okay. I think I know what you're going to say.
Well, everyone's familiar with the phrase "damning with faint praise." This is the opposite. This is praising with faint damnation, because I love this series as a whole, and it gets better as each issue it gets a little bit better. Mm. So this is the least good out of all the good issues.
Yeah,
like, you know, it, you know, you get into cults, which is one of my favorite, you know, comic book tropes. We, you know, eventually transitions to like this very Lovecraftian coastal town out in the middle of nowhere, which is great.
Yeah.
So like, this is a good issue. It's just a little boring.
You compare
to the rest of the series.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that. Definitely the weakest one of the bunch, but it gets so much better. It's definitely one of those. I mean, and then it was canceled. Series ran for 11 issues, and I, you know, then it was canceled, and I didn't find the final stories to be at all of lesser quality. Right. I thought they were still really good, especially the last three issues of this series.
Right.
Maybe that's just me, or I don't know how you feel about the final four tales.
Like this, I think I stopped reading a little while ago because I wanted to wait for us to catch up on the show before I read too far.
We'll reread
this. Yeah, definitely. This issue does like my least favorite thing when it comes to Marvel horror characters, where they keep them in New York. That's not my favorite thing. Like, you know, I don't like Ghost Rider in New York. I don't like Morbius in New York. Like, I like Ghost Rider when they took him out to the boonies. You know, in the Jason Aaron, you know, mid-aughts era. Yeah. You know, that's cool. You know, I like Morbius when he's running around the eyeball dimension or out in you know, Lovecraft Town.
Yeah.
But, you know, just a horror character in New York. I know there's a certain urban fantasy element to it. There's a Anne Rice-iness to it. I like when you take a character who doesn't fit into the typical spandex genre and you move them out of the setting for the spandex genre.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Yeah. I'm not a big fan of you know, characters being constrained within one setting. Like, for instance, Spider-Man. I love Spider-Man, but I'm not the biggest Spider-Man fan because of the fact that he's an urban superhero only. He almost never leaves New York. Right. And, you know, that is very limiting in terms of setting and in terms of stories. I mean, some listeners might agree with me here, but, you know, the thing that's different about Batman, even though he's in Gotham, he sometimes leaves. You know, he goes on adventures all over, you know, the DC universe, depending on the writer and so forth. Right. But, you know, Morbius, like you say, does that. And in fact, you know, not just Jason Aaron's Ghost Rider did that, Grant. It was also the Ghost Rider from the 70s and early 80s who did that. They took him, you know, he joined that carnival. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they traveled. Yeah, exactly. They traveled all over the country. And then he was free from the constraints of the Marvel New York, you know, universe. Yeah. And, you know, like you say, that's very appealing because it's something different. And you can get tired of things pretty quickly in the Marvel universe, I think, if you only stick to New York.
Right.
Even the X-Men, you know, they didn't just stick to New York. They were on the outskirts of New York in any way, but... Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the things I liked about that title so much in the late 70s and 80s is that they, you know, frequently traveled to space or time traveled or went to Scotland, to Muir Island, and you get to see different locales.
It's like when a Marvel character is in New York, they're having an adventure. When a Marvel character leaves New York, they're going on an adventure, which is what I like, you know.
Yeah.
So.
That's right.
You know, I like Thor off, you know, in the Nine Realms. You know, I like, you know,
same here.
Whatever, that kind of stuff. I like the Fantastic Four off in the Negative Zone. Yeah.
Speaking
like that.
About that, I mean, what you just mentioned has always been so incongruous to me. For me, Thor in New York, those stories almost never appeal to me. Like when he's fighting the Wrecking Crew in the streets of New York, that just it looks so bad. So wrong to me, you know, like a Norse god of thunder, you know, on the streets of New York. For a couple of issues that works for me, but at the end of the day, Thor being a regular superhero catching criminals on the streets, that's just weird for me. I need epic, you know, locations, other worlds, you know, a fantasy style landscapes when I read someone like Thor. But, you know, of course, that's just my preference. But I agree with what you're saying here, Grant.
That's why Jason Aaron's Jane Foster run of Thor just appealed to me like immediately. You know, not only is, you know, Jane Foster a really cool Thor, not only does she look really cool, but it just starts out with a bang off in like, you know, Roxxon's floating magic island surrounded by, you know, frost giants and a minotaur. You know, that's awesome.
Dario Agger.
Yeah. One of my favorite new villains too.
Yeah, he's so great. Yeah. That's a villain. I want an action figure of him in his full minotaur get up, but you know they haven't done that yet. But
yeah, they should do a build a figure of that.
Ooh, nice! Then we have to buy the whole set. Oh, damn! But you know, to quickly wrap up this part of the show, Grant, my Mighty Marvel missteps focuses a little bit on the ladies, even though I agreed with you that the silly ladies is something I like. For me, it's just too implausible. You know, I can accept Barbara Clark in the beginning and then Carolyn. But when they got to Madame Lyra, I was really expecting them to not do that. But I kind of saw it coming. You know, I'm like, okay, there's going to be another hot babe. So three super hot women in less than an hour. of Morbius's arrival. Plus the
flashback of a super hot fiance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Martine, yeah. Well, they give her a little bit of an aged look, but she's still a looker, like you say. So, right. Yeah, good point there. So, for me, this is definitely Marvel editorial at the time saying, what sells in these adult-oriented magazines?
Right.
Lots boobs. Of skin, boobs, figures. Put that in. Right. Put as much as you can. Now, so that's the count of four, right? And that's within 12 pages of story. And for me, that's just a little bit too much. It's basically the plan of Marvel being so transparent that you can see, okay, they want to drive sales, which is understandable with the first issue. But so right. I'm going to use that as my tentative Bronze Age or Mighty Marvel misstep. A hot-blooded guy should complain about too much girls on the page, but I am going to complain about that a little bit. Yeah.
And I have to wonder, knowing how Marvel, especially back then, did the Marvel method, where the writer does the general outline and then the artist, interprets visually, and then the writer goes back and fills in the dialogue. I wonder how much of this was Gerber just goes, Morbius kills a girl, Morbius meets a girl, Morbius, meets a fortune teller, and then Marcus went, yep, they're all pretty.
I think that's basically exactly how it happened. Like the summary you just gave, that's probably exactly how it happened. Like you got to hit these beats, right. And then
I'm sure when Steve Gerber said Morbius meets a Satanist, he wasn't thinking bikini girl in hot shorts and a go-go Satanist.
He wasn't thinking Sons of Satanish.
No.
That would be so, so weird. No, it just wouldn't work. Even though we love the Sons of Satanish, it just wouldn't work. Not that that's Satan in any way or form, but,
it's Satan-ish.
Yeah, Satan-ish. Thank you, Hub. But, a great issue in terms of, as a first issue for a Marvel Horror Mag. I'm sure you'd agree, Grant. Both of us liked it. We enjoyed it. It was a fun time. So go out there, listeners. Get it if you can. Read it if you're on Marvel Unlimited. Do it that way. Or try to buy those Vampire Tales collections.
Yeah, I think they're on Comixology too and all that.
That's right. Yeah, so get to it. All right, Grant, we're going to take a little bit of a break. And when we come back, we'll do some shop talk.
Yay. Welcome back, and now we're going to break out of the Bronze Age for a minute. We're going to talk about just whatever we're reading at the moment, whatever we picked up at the shop, either literally or figuratively, with our segment that I can't pronounce called Shop Talk. Now, with me, if you follow me on Twitter, you know that I kind of change I like to read about one character at a time. I like to really focus in on a character. And with me, it's The Thing right now. And what got me hooked on old Blue-Eyed Benji was the most recent Marvel 2-in-1 series that, if you're on Marvel Unlimited, is still coming out. I think it might have wrapped up. I don't think it's ongoing anymore. But it brings the Thing and the Human Torch back together from where the Thing had been running around with the Guardians of the Galaxy, and the Human Torch had been hanging out with the Uncanny Avengers and one of the group of the Inhumans, brings them back together as a unit. They go off in search of Reed and Sue and the kids, who are wandering the multiverse following the most recent Secret War series. It's a lot of fun. It's written by Chip Zdarsky. The artistic team rotates, but it's mostly done by Jimmy Chung, who's amazing, who did the first Young Avengers series back in the mid-aughts and has done a ton of other things since, but that's what sticks out most in my memory. And there's a lot of heart to it. It's got Dr. Doom in his infamous Iron Man gear tagging along. It introduces a new character whose name I can't remember, but is her first name is Rachna. She's a super scientist who kind of has her own agenda and is very snarky and doesn't really think much of superheroes. And it's a really fun series.
Yeah, have to apologize to you, Grant, because remember last week I went to the shop to pick up the first trade, and I did, but I haven't had a chance to read it yet. So I'm again. I mean, you didn't spoil anything, but you know, I told you I would read it by the time we recorded, and I didn't. I really have to apologize because I had a lot of other stuff on my reading docket. Because you know, these friends of mine that I have, you know, from back home in South Africa, they're also comic book fans, and they hang out at the shop every Wednesday. They've developed this system that they call the Bieber system. And what it is they recommend a comic book to me, and I recommend a comic book to them. And if I don't finish the comic after a certain period of time, I have to post a picture on Facebook of me, you know, tongue-kissing Justin Bieber.
Ew.
Yeah, so you know, no, nobody wants that. Nobody wants to have to do that. You know, have to post this picture of me tongue kissing a magazine image of Justin Bieber. So I've been very good at meeting my deadlines with the reading, you know. And they've got me. I had to read
I mean, they
four
could have at
books.
least picked Daniel Craig. You could have at least picked a decent looking guy.
I'll
They don't
tongue
have to
kiss
go
the
with
shit out of
the
Daniel Craig. Yeah. I'll tongue
Beeb.
lash him, man. I'll be all venom over his face. But yeah, come on, Bieber? No way.
No.
But no, you know, so I couldn't get to it, man. I'm so sorry. I do
That's
love the
okay.
Thing and the Human Torch in a buddy comic, though.
Yeah.
I love the issues of them in the Fantastic Four way back when, where that happened. You know, every now and then there would be an issue of just Johnny and Ben going off on their own or doing something alone. And you've got that great Waringo issue, Mark Waid and Mike Waringo, where you know, Ben finds out that the Yancey Street gang that's been tormenting him all this time, you know, isn't actually run by whom he thought the Yancey Street gang would be.
Right.
Johnny, I don't know if you've read that one, but
Oh, I have. Yeah,
oh, it's brilliant.
I'm bouncing back and forth between the Waid and Waringo run, the Roy Thomas and John Buscema
So
70s
good.
FF stuff,
Yeah.
the Jonathan Hickman FF series.
Yeah.
I'm just bouncing all over the place. I'll read like an arc of something and then switch to something else and then just on a cycle right now.
I'm so happy you're doing that, man, because the FF, man, I love them. I love them because, you know, they're not really superheroes for me. They are,
Yeah,
but the
they're
adventures.
adventurers.
Yeah, they're
Yeah.
adventures. They're Imaginauts. And, you know, they go on these crazy missions to the negative zone, you know, wherever, and to space and into space. I love that. And
Yeah.
it's not the regular, oh, this you know, bad guy of the week and villain of the month. You know, that stuff doesn't always exist in the pages. Although it depends on the writer, though. You
Right.
know, it could be
I
there,
mean,
but yeah.
there's something very visceral about a superhero going on an adventure in different locations. That's why, those of us of a certain age who remember like the Batman and Spider-Man action figures of the 90s, there was like underwater Spider-Man and space Batman and deep Arctic Spider-Man. I'm like, well, there's something, that a young mind who's unfettered with cynicism wants to see their favorite superhero go off and do bonkers ass adventures, and that's kind of what the Fantastic Four is all about,
Okay, well then, exactly, Grant. Then I'm going to challenge you now, man. I'm going to say,
Okay.
since you're sometimes also off and on reading the Fantastic Four issues from the 70s here and there, let's, even though we said we wouldn't, let's pick one issue of the Fantastic Four that we deem the weirdest, one
Okay.
each, and then in a future show we discuss that, because I somehow want to work in some Fantastic Four into the weird, because some of their stories are so crazy, just ridiculously strange. So let's do that. What do you say?
Yeah, I'm only up to 1973, but I'll yeah, definitely.
You probably encountered some weird stuff though then.
Yeah.
But okay, man, we'll do that at a later date. But I've got the strange feeling, Grant, you're not finished with Shop Talk yet, or do you want me to take over the
No,
reins briefly?
you go ahead. I'm good.
Okay, well, since he's one of our favorite characters, one of the inspirations for the show, if not the inspiration for our show, Doctor Strange, I recently read his 400th anniversary issue. I don't know if you know about that, Grant, but in a previous episode of Into the Weird, I told the listeners that I'm not into the new run by Waid and by Jesús Zayas, who's a great artist, but he, for me personally, he doesn't fit on Doctor Strange, even though he's definitely got some jaw-dropping images and single-page splash panels and so forth. I do like his art, but you know, like I, you know, told the listeners, not for me. Still, I felt compelled to pick up this anniversary issue just to see what they would do, and it really blew my mind. It was really, really great. Cool. I enjoyed it, and basically, it's a collection of tales. There's four stories in all. The main one is written by Mark Waid and Jesus Saez on art, of course, and it's again about strange and this whole thing about magic usage has consequences and so forth. But this time they introduce a new villain, the accountant, who's this guy who lives on this extra dimensional plane where, with all these little worker bee aliens who are dressed in suits and ties, and they're, you know, keeping track of magical currency and magical trade and so forth. And every time someone invokes an entity, you know, that goes on their credit. You know, that's basically how it works. So I don't like that concept, but there's this fun bit, Grant, that you would particularly love. I don't know if you want me to spoil it for you. Is it okay?
No, go ahead.
It's a very, you know, small spoiler. And listeners, beware, this is a spoiler. Strange, he meets up with the Ancient One, who has been robbed of his power. Now, the Ancient One was thought to be dead, but, you know, he was brought back into the physical world, and then this accountant, because of all the time the Ancient One had used magic, and he's now in the red in terms of what he owes, in terms of how much magic he's used over the centuries, he was punished by this accountant. But he literally performed some quick surgery on the Ancient One and ripped out this magical organ, which is the sum total of the Ancient One's magical knowledge. And then the Ancient One showed up on Doctor Strange's doorstep completely bereft of his magic. And then Strange had to sort of take care of him just like a feeble old man, and then slowly start to teach him magic. So now literally the student has become the teacher in this case. So that part is not very enjoyable, but the art is great. But then you get to
It sounds very Mark Waid.
It is very Mark Waid, but yeah, here the story really goes, you know, in a different, you know, it veers off in a different direction, Grant, because Strange tracks down this accountant in this extra dimensional plane. And then the accountant totally manipulates Strange's magic against him. So you can't beat this accountant with magic. So now you can predict what Strange did next. He went all Wong Fu on the accountant's backside, and he like completely beat him down. But in this lengthy, drawn out Frank Miller-esque Daredevil sequence of panels where he just beats up on this guy with every martial, cool looking martial arts move available to Jesus Saez, you know, cool, on art. And that was a great bit. And then, you know, you've got it ending on a bit of a cliffhanger where, you know, there's just an invasion of Dormammu's. You know, the Faultine has now come to collect the debt that Strange owes them for all the time he's used magic and not paid them back. So, you know, you've got this apocalyptic scenario. But I just like that story so much. It was, a quick Strange tale that really appealed to me. I don't know why I loved it. And then the rest of the issue has Kevin Nolan on art, you know, chronicling a tale from Doctor Strange's time as a student with the Ancient One. That was great. I love Kevin Nolan's art. You know, I don't know if you remember him from the old ABC comics that Alan Moore used to do in the late 90s.
Oh, yeah.
And he did, I think he did Jack Be Quick, a strip about a boy genius. I love that. So Kevin Nolan was there. And then, you know, you've got two other stories that were also great. There's one, Grant, you would absolutely love. It's only about Nightmare, your favorite Doctor Strange villain. But get this. Okay, spoilers, listeners. Again, a spoiler warning. This is just basically the idea of the tale. It doesn't give away the story. Nightmare is having a nightmare about Doctor Strange. That's what the whole thing is about. When Doctor Strange, you know, dreams, he has nightmares of Nightmare, right? But when Nightmare falls asleep in the Nightmare dimension, he has nightmares of Doctor Strange beating him over and over. That's pretty awesome. And you've got art there by Daniel Acuna, who's great. So if you remembered him from the Uncanny Avengers run, right? I think it was. So, such a good issue. I'm so happy with the Doctor Strange 400th anniversary issue, yeah. Grant. It just gave me this bubbly feeling inside. It's just full of the, you know, the flames of the Faultine just bursting out of my heart here.
That's in awesome. Joy,
oh. Yeah.
Oh, and readers, if you've read the new Doctor Strange series and you like Jesus Saez, I highly recommend that you check out the latter half of the new 52 Swamp Thing series, where it's about three or four issues into Charles Soule's run, which is the second half of the series. The art mixed with the color palette on that is phenomenal.
Wow.
But yeah, Jesus did the art on that. It's really, really good.
Great recommendation. I agree with you there, Grant. That's masterful what he accomplished there. So, Grant, any other things you want to mention for Shop Talk?
Nope, good to go on Shop Talk.
About done. Well, then that leads into your favorite segment, my favorite segment of the show, and that is
Get Off My Lawn.
Oh yeah, here we go.
Party's over. Everyone go home. Next time, my place.
So who are you, man? Shit!
I'm the party pooper.
And we're back with our actual favorite segment, the one that we call Get Off My Lawn. Now, those of you that have listened to us frequently may know that Get Off My Lawn is our segment where we poke good-natured fun at comics that exist outside, normally poke good-natured fun at comics that exist outside the Bronze Age that we're intimately familiar with, that have something to do with our subject matter for that episode. Not so much this month. We're going to diverge a bit.
We're going to speculate. We're going to speculate.
Yeah, we're going to speculate. We're going to throw some. We're going to throw some poo with the walls this week, guys. This is a comic that is not out yet. It just hit solicits for, I think, either April or May of 2019. And the comic is called Savage Avengers. so here we go. Now, this is written by Jerry Duggan, who we both like very much. So we're not saying this is a bad comic. By any means, I think it's by Deodato. Okay, I can, you know, Deodato's a skillful artist. I think it's by him. I think that's who did the cover anyway. And it's, you know, Jerry Duggan, he's done Guardians, which I really liked. He did
Deadpool.
He did Deadpool, which I don't like, but he did Uncanny, the third volume of Uncanny Avengers, which had Deadpool in it for some inexplicable reason other than the fact that Jerry Duggan just likes Deadpool. But I also had my favorite interpretation of Cable since the last Secret War series, so it's very good. It's the that's the run where Cable shoots a giant zombie Hulk with a big gun named Jean. There's nothing not to like about that, so it's good stuff. Okay, so here's the lineup. So you have Wolverine, okay? Somebody else edgy, I don't remember. You have Elektra, who appeared in an arc of Uncanny Avengers, and he kind of teased the idea of Elektra eventually joining the Avengers, which I can see.
Well, that would Conan. Be fun. Oh yeah, there we go. That's the one I've been waiting for.
So Conan's. Oh, and that's not my biggest gripe, because, you know, as we all know, or we should know, Marvel has retained the rights to publish Conan material. I wonder if they're going to be publishing the Dark. Yeah, they're publishing the Dark Horse stuff too, which is neat.
Oh, I didn't even know that. I didn't know they got the rights to the Dark Horse, but
because they did the same thing that they did when they got the rights to do Star Wars. They got all the they got all the Dark Horse Star Wars stuff too.
Interesting,
because they got the rights from the Howard Estate. And you know, I'm okay with, you know, an adventure of Conan being stuck in the modern era for six issues or whatever. That sounds fun. It kind of takes back to, you know, what if,
yeah,
you know, what if,
yeah,
that, yeah, that from the 70s or the early 80s, what if Conan was in the modern day?
Yeah.
But it's got the Punisher in it, guys.
Yeah.
I hate the Punisher. I hate the Punisher. I'm not a big Avengers fan, but the Punisher should not be a member of the Avengers.
No, I agree. Don't call it Avengers. I mean, it's fine if the Punisher is part of a team of badasses, like, let's say, Deadpool.
Making a new Thunderbolts.
Yeah, Thunderbolts, which they did before. Yeah.
But,
okay, now, Grant, I agree with you. This is going to, just for the listeners, our Get Off My Lawn segment includes the exact same gripe. Grant and I both agreed before we did the show, before we started the show, that we hate the idea of the Savage Avengers. But, you know, we're going to give it a try. We're going to see it, of course. We're going to read it. We want to, you know, give our two cents on how it's like. But come on, it just doesn't work for me. I mean, Conan alone in a team called Avengers, and then you've got a Punisher being an Avenger. I mean, didn't Captain America once in the annals of comic-dom
beat the hell out of the Punisher?
Yeah, and refused to let him join the Avengers because... you know, of what he stands for, because he's basically a murderer. He's a serial killer.
Venom.
Like,
Venom's the other edgy character.
Venom is there, and then, you know, like you mentioned, Wolverine, the actual Wolverine. Hot claws, Wolverine.
Right.
Hot claws.
I like that he's in the brown costume, at least.
Okay, that's good.
That's pretty cool.
But now
I miss the brown costume.
But now think about the image of the brown costume, Grant, with these, you know, burning white hot or red hot claws.
Is that a permanent thing? Or is that just something from him having one of the Infinity Stones? Is that a thing now?
I haven't read the recent issues. I just can't believe they gave, who is it, Charles Soule that did Wolverine, the death of Wolverine? He's back on Wolverine again. So not one of my favorite arcs of Wolverine that he wrote in the past, but now he's back again. I mean, what kind of monopoly does he have on the character that they just keep giving it to him?
I don't know.
But anyway, point is, I don't think it's going to be permanent, but for now it's still an ongoing thing, I think.
Yeah.
Even though I haven't read any of the new Wolverine comics, I just don't like that idea at all. But, you know, the writer's trying.
I assume it's supposed to be a limited run. I don't know. I mean, I could maybe speculate on the format of it. Maybe this team, you know, Conan is loose in the modern era, and this team was put together to kind of keep an eye on Conan. I don't know.
I don't like the Punisher.
For the most part, I do not like characters that use guns. Cable's the one exception to that, just because they're big, goofy science fiction guns that have a stun setting. Mm. I don't like guys. Okay, look, I live in Florida. I live in the school shooting capital of the United States. I live 300 miles from Parkland, Florida. Mm. I don't like people that use, like, actual realistic assault rifles in comic books. That's a no bueno for me.
Yeah,
I've never liked the Punisher. I think he's boring. I think he's an interesting exploration of mental illness, but I don't like him as an aspirational character, which is what, unfortunately, he became.
Yeah, he shouldn't be. No, well, as you know, Grant, I'm a big horror fan. So, you know, when I read a lot of the comic books, I don't latch on to one character in the comic books per se. You know, so. Let's say, for instance, I'm reading a comic book like American Vampire. You know, there isn't one particular character from DC Vertigo that I particularly like. I mean, I like Pearl Jones, the female protagonist, but she's not in a lot of the stories, you know. But I just like the story, the mythology behind it, and the horror elements to it. You know, what's going to happen next? The Punisher is kind of like that for me. You know, like if I read a good Punisher Max tale about war... you know, the horrors of war, which is supposed to put you off of war. And that frequently has that effect, right? It scares you so bad because Garth Ennis is so good at portraying that. And that is actually his main intent. It's not just to sell issues. His intent is to showcase the horrors of war. He said that in many, interviews. Then I can handle the Punisher. I can read a story where this horror comes through. And if the Punisher is the main character, then, you know, whatever. But I don't like it if they include him in a superhero team. Because superheroes are not about, well, for me, this is my opinion, they're not about killing people with guns. I mean, I like the character Wild Dog from DC, you know, as a fun experiment. I dig him, especially, you know, in the Young Animal imprint where he is with Cave Carson. I like that because he's a funny character. He's kind of like Deadpool. You know, he's irreverent and stuff like that. Frank Castle's not that. He's a super serious mass murderer who's in a hero role. You know, this ultimate revenge fantasy, which is very scary if you think kids are reading this stuff, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, I took my kid to the zoo this past weekend, and I saw a kid that was like 9 years old walking around wearing a Punisher t-shirt. I'm like, That's a parenting fail.
Well, no, you could say the same thing about Wolverine, even though I really love Wolverine. But you can also not say the same thing, because Wolverine and the Punisher aren't the same character. Yes, Wolverine goes off on a killing frenzy every now and then. He's out of control. He gets into his berserker rage mode. But he doesn't actively set out to kill every single antagonist. He has a modicum of self-control. He doesn't relish the kill.
Right.
As much as the Punisher does. Of course, Wolverine does enjoy fighting and killing, but not to on the Punisher's level, where it's become this the sole purpose of his life.
Right. And Claremont would be very, even when it got into the early modern age, like between 85 and 1990, because of course in the Bronze Age, it was, a lot of, Wolverine slashes your gun, or Wolverine hacks up a giant alien spider, but he doesn't really kill a lot of people.
Mm.
But even in the early modern age, Claremont would be very, very clear to say, if a guy comes, Wolverine's doing like the internal monologue, if a guy comes at me with his fist and he gets a fist, if a guy pulls a knife or a gun, he gets the claws.
Mm.
Okay, cool. Yeah, killing in self-defense is a reasonable response to some forms of violence. I understand that. But it's... I don't know. It's the Batman. Batman himself is an exploration of mental illness. The Punisher is the next step. Step further.
No, I agree with you. Now look at the team, right? Grant, you've got Wolverine, then you've got the Punisher, Conan, Elektra, Venom. If you just look at them like that in quick succession, they are the killers, the supreme killers of the Marvel Universe. Conan's body count is way higher than anything the Punisher could ever aspire to, I'm sure.
And I know it was a different Venom at the time. It was Flash Thompson at the time. But three of those members were the Thunderbolts a while ago.
Adding
Ghost Rider and Deadpool, and that was that team, which was a really fun read.
Hmm.
That's one of the few examples where I didn't mind the Punisher, because they took it in such an outlandish direction. Like, okay, we're doing some really weird stuff. They all go to hell. That was fun.
That was fun. I agree, but in this case, it's not. I mean, there's two problems I have with this. This is basically Kill Team Avengers. Now, if you did that with Black Ops X-Men, like they did with Wolverine's X-Force that he, created twice in the past, for the specific purposes of destroying threats that are deemed, so great that they could impact the world or destroy the world, or apocalyptic level threats, I'm fine with that. So I don't know the premise behind the Savage Avengers. Why have they been formed? But why call them Avengers? The Avengers are not about killing. They're not about they're about stopping threats. Yes, but
and also between the two X-Force teams, the Black Ops X-Force Wolverine teams, arguably, at least in my opinion, the better of the two is the one that was written by Rick Remender, Uncanny X-Force, because the whole point of the series is if you're willing to go to that length to achieve your goals, here are the consequences, and everyone on your team is going to suffer for it.
That's right. Now, this is where the speculation aspect of our criticism comes in, Grant. We don't know anything about this series other than the lineup and the creators, right?
Yeah.
We know Duggan's a good writer, and like you've mentioned, Diodato has some strengths, but so we don't know anything. I'm just saying that based on the idea alone, I don't like it. I don't want it. The main reason is actually not the Punisher and the fact that they call it the Avengers. That's definitely an issue for me. But the main reason is Conan. Conan doesn't work well in the larger Marvel universe. I mean, those what-if issues were interesting. The first what-if issue was just Conan in New York. He meets a girl and, runs afoul of the police. But the second one was Conan meeting up with Thor. Now, that one challenged my believability, because Thor, god-level strength, almost on par with the Hulk, and then you see Conan holding his own against Thor. That's already like stretching the bounds of belief in terms of what we've come to expect of the Marvel Universe. Conan is ridiculously strong, but he's just not as strong on that level.
Even in the Bronze Age, when they would take elements from the Conan stories and bring them into the greater Marvel Universe, like, Kulan Goth and stuff like that, I never bought Conan's era as the Marvel Universe's path.
And it shouldn't be.
Saw it as like a parallel dimension that existed within the greater Marvel multiverse.
That's the way they should have kept it. And I'm sure if you interview Roy Thomas, the interview might have already happened. you know, yeah. he would say, no, I don't like that. Or he probably can't say that. I don't know. Right. But
you know. I do like it when they take elements of Conan and bring them into the, again, Kulan Goth arc of Uncanny X-Men in the mid-80s is great.
Oh, yeah, that's bordering on horror. That's bordering on horror. I love that story.
And the Serpent Crown stuff, you know, from, because that brings elements of Kahl and Conan and all that yeah. stuff, but not so much. This just comes across as them, here's our new thing, let's milk it.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
We've got Conan back. Let's milk Conan the way we milked their Deadpool. And yeah. I used to like Deadpool.
I know, once
you milk a character to death, they're not fun anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as a positive aside to this whole discussion, Grant, I can say that I've read the first three issues of Jason Aaron's Conan, and I've recently read The Savage Sword of Conan by Jerry Duggan, in fact. You know, the writer of Savage Avengers. He wrote The Savage Sword, and all three of the Jason Aaron issues plus the Savage Sword issue from Duggan just blew my mind. It's so good. It's Conan, it's classic Conan, but with the modern writer sensibilities and writing chops, and it's sophisticated storytelling, but also great art. I love it. I'm
really looking forward
to
that.
Future of Conan, but now they've got this Savage Avengers just.
Well, and again, we could be completely wrong, because I remember when the idea of Weapon H came out, the Hulk variant. I thought, this is the stupidest damn thing I've ever heard. I don't need that. Get off my lawn. And then I read it, and it's pretty good.
Well,
it's Greg Pak. You know, I like Greg Pak in general. The Weapon X series that it's spun out of, not the greatest. It's kind of fun. The Weapon H series is really good, and it brings in a lot of cool horror elements to it. Like, he fights a super version of the Wendigo. He fights the Brood. He fights Dario Agger. It's a lot of fun.
Well, you recommended that series to me couple of months ago, and I enjoyed the heck out of it. That plus the Weapon X series that's concurrently running along with Weapon H. I enjoyed both. But the Weapon H series was so crazy, and that would fit in so well if we did modern weird comic tales, because that is very weird.
Agreed.
You know, I loved it, and thanks for recommending that, Grant. But, you know, then it works. As a team where you've got these monsters and these mutants who kill, it works. They're running from the government. They're running from secret organizations. You know, they're fighting for their lives against alien creatures who might take over the planet. That's fine. Those are cannon fodder enemies. You know, slice them apart. But now you've got the Avengers. We're talking Avengers here. What if the Savage Avengers goes up against the Masters of Evil? Yeah, heads are going to be lopped off, bullet holes in bodies. I don't want to see that. I mean, if they can come up with new enemies who deserve that, like, you know, for instance, we just mentioned the Brood. I'm fine with people like going all, you know, crazy on the Brood and just like mowing them down, which is Wolverine is so good at. But, you know, they're called the Avengers. I can't belabor this point enough.
And like I said, you know, we're not saying this is going to be a bad series. We're saying we're skeptical of the concept.
Yeah.
But because we both like the writer, we, you know, concede that he could pull it off. You know, it could be that this, you know, Wolverine is using the Avengers name unsanctioned.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, okay. That's the nice thing about Get Off My Lawn, is we can look back on previous episodes and say we were so wrong.
Right.
But we can also say, damn, man, we hit the nail on the head. So I'm excited to see what's going to happen with our, you know, it's not a prediction, listeners. We're not predicting that it's going to be bad.
No,
like you said,
I
Grant,
don't think it's
it might be really good. It might be appealing to a certain fan base. We're going to read it, but we're just saying that right at this moment, I'm not sure, just as Conan's popularity is soaring, and just as the Avengers is so popular, I'm not sure this is what you need to show kids. Yeah. I mean, if I look at the kids here in Taipei, they love the Avengers. They love the Avengers so much, but now you've got Avengers who kill.
Yeah.
Basically, the kill team Avengers. I don't know if that's sending the right message. Anyway,
honestly, if they substituted the Punisher for any other edgy character, if it was like Ghost Rider or something, I'd be perfectly fine. Well, of course, Robbie Reyes is already in the regular Avengers
series, where I love him.
I mean, like old school, like Johnny Blaze, Ghost Rider, or
hardcore,
you know, Damon Hellstrom, or somebody. I don't care.
Any of those guys could be a suitable, well, substitute. But, you know, so we'll wait and see, Grant. I'm sure we might be proven wrong, but, you know, we might also not. It might bomb. I'm hoping it doesn't bomb because...
No, I hope it doesn't
bomb. So that's not what we're hoping for, but I'm just not, you know, so excited about it. But, you know, Grant, I think that's about enough of you know, letting the listeners' ears bleed.
Yeah, we've kvetched enough.
Yeah, but, you know, that's the fun about the Get Off My Lawn section. Yeah. We're old. We're ornery. We've got to let off some steam every now and then.
Yeah.
Listen, so the next segment, listeners, is going to be our Nexus of All Reviews. And then later on, we're going to do a quick Allies of Agamotto, but since we haven't done the show in the wild, we're going to focus on something different during that segment, but we'll leave that for later. But before we get to the Nexus, I do want to play a quick promo. It's one of the shows that you and I really love, Grant, that inspired us to, in fact, do Into the Weird. And we're going to listen to that promo. And after that, we'll get to the Nexus. So here we go.
Hi everybody, my name's Hub, and I host a show called Tighten Up the Defense, a podcast that would likely benefit from a tagline. Every week, we read either a Defenders comic book from the 70s or a New Teen Titans comic from the 80s. I give a synopsis of that comic that I have handcrafted to amuse and inform, and then my good-for-many-things brother Corey comes over and we talk about what we found interesting about the comic we just read. It's a lot of fun, and we hope you'll join us for it. Anything you'd like to add, Corey?
I like cocaine from an animal's butthole. It is. So good.
It is.
Paradise.
Well, Corey, I don't really think that's appropriate. We're trying to do a promotion for our podcast here.
Shut up.
Okay, fair enough. Any final thoughts?
Of course.
Well, let's hear them.
I have eaten all the beaver butt. You have eaten none. And beaver's butt. This is pretty good.
There you have it. Tighten Up the Defense. That's TITAN. You can find it wherever podcasts are found. It's probably worth mentioning. I'm the one who does the editing. Catch the wave of the future and hang 10 on it with us. Cowabunga.
All right, for the Nexus of All Reviews segment, Grant, we've got a friend of the show who gave us a brilliant review on iTunes. Once again, for new listeners, this is our system that Grant and I developed, or it's actually your brainchild, Grant, and it's a good one, where listeners who like the show and deem us worthy of a 5-star rating on iTunes get their very own special Marvel Bronze Age superhero identity, courtesy of you and I. So this week, it's the turn of, like I say, a good friend of the show, Dan O. Cosmic. You know him, Grant. He's frequently he frequently converses with us on Twitter.
And very good dude.
Great guy. He's a lover of all things Marvel Cosmic and lots of other stuff. Very knowledgeable about comics in general. Very nice guy.
He's filled in a lot of gaps in my cosmic knowledge. It's very helpful. Great resource if you know the guy, if you have any questions about cosmic stuff. He is the answer man.
Yeah, just follow him on Twitter. He's at Dan O. Cosmic on Twitter. You can just type that in and easily find his Twitter handle there. And I'm going to quickly read the review he left us. It's short, but to the point. And he said, 5-star, great show. Grant and Herman know their subject matter well and present it in an interesting and fun format, covering a weird and wonderful period in comics. Here for it, from Dan O. Cosmic. So, very nice, succinct review. Thanks, Dan, for that. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan.
And because of that, of course, Dan, you're entitled to your very own Bronze Age superhero moniker. Okay, so to come up with this, we looked at what Dan was into. So obviously, Dan is into a lot of Marvel Cosmic stuff. And I took that into account, but I also took the fact that, you know, he's got an O in there somewhere, Dan O. Cosmic. So you'll see where that plays in when we get to the origin. And I hope you like it, Dan. If you don't, I'm sure I can come up with another one, but I'm hoping this one will satisfy your superhero identity craving here. So I'm going to kick it off. Grant, are you ready?
absolutely.
Okay, so here we go with Dan O'Cosmic's moniker. What lies on the other side of the Rainbow Bridge? Why does a cosmic entity like Galactus prefer to leave the magical realms of the Marvel Universe alone? And why does the name of one young leprechaun send fear into the hearts of Celestials, Shi'ar, Skrulls, and Kree's alike? The answers to these questions and more lie in the origin of Dan O'Cosmic, the Leprechosmicon. We all know that the Rainbow Bridge originates in fabled Asgard, but where does it end? Simple, in the land of the leprechauns, right at the base of a giant cauldron of gold that would make King Midas or Auric Goldfinger drool with envy. But who guards this most sacred of all treasures? None other than the greatest, toughest, fiercest St. Paddy's Day brawler the cosmos has ever seen. A young leprechaun named Dan O'Normal. But one fateful day, doom came to the land of the leprechauns in the form of Galactus, eater of worlds and defiler of four-leafed clovers. It was brave Dan who halted Galactus's hunger with a heroic sacrifice. In return for the land at the end of the rainbow's safety, Dan would sacrifice himself to become a herald for the great Galactus. With a gesture, the Eater of Worlds transformed Dan into a cosmic avatar, substituting his tough, red-haired epidermis with pure, cosmic-powered gold. Now named Dan O'Cosmic, and joining his master as a rider of the spaceways on a giant golden Blarney stone, Dan soon rebelled when he learned that pints were hard to come by in space. And when his master protested, Dan promptly administered a good thrashing. Since then, Galactus has left the magical realms alone, as they are now and forever vigilantly patrolled by the invincible, the indefatigable, the ineluctable, the inebriated Leprechosmicon. The end.
Pretty cool.
Yep, that's it, Dan. I hope you like it, man. You're the Leprechosmicon. Keep Very us safe. Nice. All right, Grant, so that's it for this week. Next up, we'll have another moniker for another five-star review. We've got quite a few to go through. I think we've still got 7 left.
Yep, I'll be handling the next one. Herman's better at it than I am, but no, I'll give it a shot.
No, man. Remember that very first one? That very first one you did about the Radio Ronin? Ooh, that inspired
me. Your narratives are great, though.
Hey, well, you could write it. I could do the narrative thing if you want. But, you've also got a great voice, dude. You can just... I mean, I love your impression of Ben, of the thing.
You mean of the ever-loving blue-eyed thing?
Yeah.
Sorry, and if any of you out there listen to the god-awful movies or the Scathing Atheist, my thing impersonation is very close to Carl the Pug of Pegacorn. That's a deep cut, but I hope at least one of you will get that reference.
I want to listen to that then, man. How come you don't? You should tout yourself more, promote yourself more. <You're... laughs> Awesome, Grant. Awesome, buddy. So we're just going to lead right on into our next segment. Jump right on in with the Allies of Agamotto. Now, there's not going to be a break in between segments here because we really don't have any allies this week. Well, not in the terms
fault for not keeping up with our record keeping. Normally, Allies of Agamotto is where we acknowledge those of you who are nice enough to follow us, to like us, to retweet us, to forward us on Facebook, all that good stuff. Do we have a Facebook? I don't think we have a Facebook.
No.
Or to like the blog anyway. But we've been doing this so sporadically because of logistical issues. It's just about become a monthly thing. What we're going to do this month, at least, we are going to do shout outs to podcasts that we follow, that we like, that we support, that we think you ought to go listen to. I think the perfect one to start us out with is Tighten Up the Defense. At least for me, that show was the inspiration for me to suggest this show. for Herman, for he and I to do. It's hosted by a fantastic gentleman who goes by the name of Hub and his brother Corey, where they talk about Bronze Age Teen Titans and the Defenders. It's a lot of fun. It's really funny. I support him on Patreon. You ought to as well. It is hands down one of the best comic book podcasts out there right now.
Agreed. Completely agreed. That's, like you say, Grant, the reason why we started our show is because of the enthusiasm that Hub and his brother Corey and his wife Lisa has for the medium. Yes. So thanks for that, for tightening up the defense. Any others, Grant? Any other podcasts? Or
I'm a big fan of Radio versus the Martians. It's hosted by Mike Gillis and Casey Dorn. It's not just a comic book podcast. It's a just general nerd culture thing. They talk about everything from Vertigo comics to manga to professional wrestling to
Arnold Schwarzenegger movies.
Yeah, the stupid movies with the cars, with Vin Diesel.
Fast and the Furious.
Right. Yeah, those. The two of them, they're so charismatic. I give no shits about wrestling, and I hate the Fast and Furious movies. I have listened to those two their episodes they've done about those things multiple times just because I like listening to these two guys.
They're just so funny. They're just so humorous, and their voices, you know, just make you want to laugh. It's just a feel-good show all around.
Right, and one of the things I really like about it is Mike knows a lot of people in the general podcasting realm, like, he's good friends with Rob Kelly, whose show we've appeared on before. We've appeared on one of Rob's many shows, Treasury Cast. Yeah. He's good friends with the guys and the ladies who do the View from the Gutters podcast. So he's kind of like the hub in the middle of the spokes of podcasting sometimes.
Yeah, I agree. A great podcast. I mean, so many other podcast recommendations I got from just listening to that show. So, you know, it's definitely one everybody needs to listen to. And you can also support them on Patreon as well. Both of you and I support them, right, Grant? Because it's so worth it.
Absolutely. Yep.
And you get updates, and the Patreon page or offers that they have for subscribers is just great. It's so worth your money. And I don't know if you want to keep going, Grant, or do you want me to jump in anytime?
Yeah, there's one other one I want to throw a shout out to. I'm not a huge horror fan. That's more Herman's thing, but I do like horror themed podcasts. I don't like anthologies in general, but there's one show called The Magnus Archives, and on the surface it's a horror anthology, but all the stories eventually tie into one each other. It's got a fantastic narrative. It's basically about a guy who's the archivist for a organization that documents supernatural happenings, and all the episodes are him reading back the statements of people who've come into this organization to tell about these weird things that happened to them. And then as you listen, you'll start to pick up little things here and there. It's like, oh, well, that tied into something 16 issues ago. And then, oh, well, that tied into something 4 issues ago. Then it all builds and builds and builds and ties into this like one greater storyline. It's really good.
Wow. The Magnus Archives, you say?
Magnus Archives. Mm-hmm. Whoa, yeah, it's a British podcast. It's really good.
That sounds right up my alley.
Yeah, it's one of the few things that I listen to weekly, so you should check that out.
Thanks, man. I got to give that a listen.
Sure.
Well, from my side, it's I agree with the three shows you mentioned, Grant. Well, with the first two, I mean, I've yet to listen to the Magnus Archives. Of course, we're friends with the guys from the Fire and Water Network, like Rob Kelly and Shag Matthews and Ryan Daly. And one of the shows I want to shout out is Ryan's Midnight, the Podcasting Hour. In fact, I recently appeared on an episode with Clinton Robeson from Coffee and Comics, another show I want to give a shout out to later. But we did a Swamp Thing centered show from the early issues of Swamp Thing, Bernie Wrightson and Len Wein. So definitely give Ryan Daly's Midnight, the Podcasting Hour, a listen. And then Professor Allen's Quarterbin Podcast, one of my favorite shows. I love to listen to Professor Allen's dulcet tones. You know, as he goes through the issues he picked up on the cheap, he's very knowledgeable.
He has one of the smoothest voice in podcasting.
That's what I was going to mention. And speaking about voices, really, really distinctive voices, Chris and Reggie's Cosmic Treadmill. Both of those guys have great voices, but Reggie, man, he's got probably the deepest voice I've ever heard. And the, his voice is very distinctive, a very good podcasting voice, very arresting voice. So give the Treasury, give the Cosmic Treadmill a listen. You can also subscribe to them on Patreon. They offer great rewards, and that's a good show if you want to get into the history of comics. How was comics made? How did the writers and artists get together? How did, you know, the publishing companies come up with the idea behind it? And it's great for comic book history buffs. And then we mentioned Tighten Up the Defense earlier, Grant. If you subscribe to them on Patreon, if you become a Patreon supporter for as little as $1 a month, you are privy to listen to What the Duck, a Howard the Duck podcast run by Lisa.
Are you trying to say the whole name?
okay. Let me see if I can get this right. What the Duck?
What the Duck? A podcast most foul.
Yeah, a podcast most foul.
Because it's a duck.
Yeah, but with a W. Oh man, it's so funny. You know, you've got Hub from Tighten Up the Defense, and then you've got his wife Lisa, and both of them are so humorous. They're so good, and in completely different ways. But yes, you could see why they married each other. They must have a laugh a minute every day of their lives. They must have such a happy couple.
And Hub, if by any chance you listen to this, please put out more episodes of the Haunted Disco Barn. That is the best thing in podcasting I've ever listened to. I know you probably shelled out some money for that, because I believe that you got a professional actress to be one of the voices. Please put out more of those. Even if you make it a Patreon exclusive, please do more Haunted Disco Barn.
That was brilliant. I think he said he's only going to do that every Christmas, but I'm hoping that he could do that every other holiday.
Yeah.
Or Halloween. Halloween. It was Halloween.
Yeah. I'd love a Haunted Disco Barn. Like a Valentine's episode would have been amazing. But
yeah, well, the guy's busy, but still, you know, he's so talented and so funny. Really, he could do stand-up comedy. He probably has done it. I don't know, but I'm sure he'd be a success with that. So definitely give that a listen. And I also want to mention the Professor Frenzy show run by Jerry and Chris. And that's a great show if you ever want to know what's happening on the indie scene, especially with horror comics, science fiction comics, non-superhero related titles. Chris and Jerry will have you covered. Jerry is a big supporter of our show, Chris too, on Twitter. So give that a listen. The Professor Frenzy show. I love that show. It's so cool. Finally, I want to shout out Clinton's Coffee and Comics podcast. You know, what I like about Clinton's Coffee and Comics podcast, Grant, is they have revolving guests, much like the Fire and Water Network, like Treasury Cast, like we were on. Mm-hmm. Clinton always has a guest. From our circle of podcasting friends, from our network of Twitter, you know, friends. And you get so much insight into different podcasts and different perspectives and different views on every single show. And then you've got Clinton himself, who's just a fan. He's a pure fan of comics, and you can feel his love just flowing through the speakers when you listen to it. He loves comics and he loves podcasting. And, you know, I like it when you can feel the enthusiasm. And then finally, the Collected Edition and the Nexus of All Realities, a Man Thing podcast. We've mentioned them before when we did the Man Thing episode of Savage Tales, right, Grant? It's run by Paul Matthew Carr. He runs a host of podcasts and he's very good. He's a writer by trade, but he's also very eloquent when he speaks. And you can hear that. You can hear that he's a writer. He almost like frames his thoughts like a writer would, you know, very elegantly and so forth. So I really dig all of his shows. And those are the ones I think the listeners should give a try if they've not already listened to them, because basically our listeners fall in our wheelhouse of interests. So they might already know. This might, you know, not be anything new to them. So then, Grant, before we finish the show, I also want to mention two blogs that they're supporters of our show as well. And one we've already mentioned, Billy Delicious from the Magazines and Monsters blog. You can find him at magazinesandmonsters.com. He's a huge Marvel fan, especially of the Bronze Age. He once a week he posts these great articles and blogs about Marvel issues that he picked up recently, or what he picked up when he was a kid. And it's a real sense of nostalgia that comes through, but in a good way, you know. He really fires me up every time he posts something about horror, for instance.
He's also been a big supporter of ours on Twitter.
That's right.
So,
yeah, he was one of our first listeners. So thanks, Billy, and everybody should check out. And then his blog. And then last but not least, The Telltale Mind. Mm-hmm. A great blog. I think The Telltale Mind posts daily, you know, so that's a blog you should check out if you're into pop culture at all, but especially comics and movies even, but mostly comics. Check out thetelltalemind.com. They're also a big supporter of ours. So, Grant, that's it for the Allies of Akamoto this week. I can't think of anything else that I want to say, but I guess we should make a little bit of an announcement about the format of the show and what we're going to be picking for subsequent shows. We've decided on a bit of a change of pace.
Yeah, we were trying to go in order. We'd picked a list of titles and characters we wanted to follow, and we tried to map it out. And honestly, that got a little tiresome. So we're just going on whatever strikes our fancy and within our general wheelhouse. We both like Man-Thing, and we both like Ben Grimm Thing. So next episode, whenever we get a chance to do it, it's going to be Marvel 2-in-1 number 1 from 1974 featuring the Thing and Man-Thing.
Woohoo! I can't wait.
Yay.
Yeah, my favorite Marvel superhero. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking Morbius here. I'm talking Ben Grimm.
Right.
And one of my favorite Marvel horror characters, Man-Thing, it's got to be a winner. So looking forward to that, Grant. But with that, dear listeners, dear weirdlings, or whatever we call you, weirdos, we have to say goodbye. But we'll be back hopefully sooner rather than later.
Stay weird.
Stay weird, guys. Take care of yourselves. Bye. The Into the Weird podcast welcomes feedback of all kinds, even vitriol. If you would like to reach us, you can contact us by sending an email to sinkintotheweird@gmail.com. Also, check out the blog at sinkintotheweird.com. You can follow Grant on Twitter at stormchaser2162. Or you can follow me, Herman Lowe, at Dark Longbox. Finally, Grant and I would just like to say thanks to our gracious and unofficial sponsor, the band Seven Kingdoms, who lent us their song In the Walls for our main show theme. And with that, weird listeners, it's goodbye from me. Until next time.